This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking to leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Gary Wheeler, the CEO of the American Society of Interior Designers, or as it's more commonly known, the ASID. A professional membership organization for both commercial and residential designers, the ASID is almost 100 years old, but Gary has been in the top spot for less than 12 months. With a global pandemic to contend with and racial inequality at the forefront, he's had a busy start to his tenure. I spoke with Gary about why he wants to end the squabbling between commercial and residential designers, the danger of interior design being taxed as a luxury, and why now is the right time to invite everyone to the table. This podcast was sponsored by Serena and Lily. With a dedicated trade team and design shops from coast to coast, Serena and Lily's exclusive trade program has the personalized service, products, and custom details you need to execute your vision seamlessly. From trade-only discounts to complimentary swatches, COM to custom by the inch, being a Serena and Lily trade member offers endless inspiration, giving you and your clients the unique look you deserve. Join their trade program by visiting serenaandlily.com/trade. This podcast was also sponsored by Artistic Tile. Artistic Tile knows that bringing a client's vision to life often requires customization. Artistic Tile developed the Tailored To program to offer custom solutions to your tile design challenges. Almost any stocked material can be cut into hundreds of mosaics, dozens of field tile sizes, or given a new finish in a very short time frame. Learn more at artistictile.com/BOH. And now, on with the show. I'm excited to have this conversation, and I realized that probably a great place for us to start is really to have you tell us exactly what the ASID is. If you would explain for listeners, what is the ASID today and what's the operation all about?
ASID has been and always has been an organization made up of all facets of the interior design industry: residential, contract, healthcare, hospitality, all ranges. And I think that is what makes it unique. And we're the only one in the interior design industry that does that in America and globally, actually, as well as we do. We have about 23,000 members, about 50% practice residential exclusively, about 50% corporate. And then there's that mix in the middle that do both. And so therefore, you get a real diversity of background and thought and education and experience. You're not talking to yourself all the time. And I've been a member for a long time, but one of the reasons is I was a corporate design. I did, you know, millions of square feet all over the world, but I belonged to ASID because when I went to a meeting, I talked to people that didn't do what I did, had different resources, different connections, different networks, and it has expanded my reality base far beyond anything I ever anticipated as a designer.
Well, and you really have a personal history with the ASID. Tell us a little bit about that and sort of how you first encountered this organization and how old is the organization itself?
Well, actually, it's from the 30s, so it's been around forever. It's almost 100 years old. It's interesting in that when I was in university, I had a professor, the head of the design school, come to me and say, I want you to go to a conference. And I said, okay, whatever you tell me to do, I'll do, because she ran my life. And she sent me to San Francisco to the first student conference that the predecessor to ASID, AID, hosted. There were 28 students. Today at our conferences, we have hundreds of students attend, but then there were 28 of us, and we're the founding student members of ASID. Since then, every key thing in my career, every job, every major friend in the profession, most of my contacts have had a direct connection somehow to ASID throughout my career. My first company that I owned with Nyla Lizowitz, who eventually became head of Gensler in Chicago, then on to Perkins & Will, from there to Gensler in London, back to the U.S., all of that had a connection at some point with someone that I knew from ASID or a reference or an introduction or in some way. So my career has been hugely impacted as a practitioner.
Last time you and I spoke, one of the things that stuck in my mind was you talked about early days of the ASID in your career. One of the things you said to me was that you met many of your design heroes through the ASID. And I was struck by that, and I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about that, because I haven't had that experience myself, and I want to hear from you about that.
That is such a wonderful thing. I met my first boss, Edward J. Perot. He was president of AID at the time, but Angelo Donghia ended up being a great friend, and I helped bring $1 million into the foundation from the Donghia Foundation. I could go on for hours with names. Holly Hunt, I met her, interestingly, at one of the founding meetings for DIFA in Chicago when Nyla and I were in our late 20s, maybe early 30s, when DIFA, no one even knew what that word meant yet. And we were at a fundraiser in Chicago, were invited, and I met people like Holly, who has now remained a part, I've worked for her, I did her London showroom. How would you ever be able to do that if it wasn't for the introductions you get through the professional association?
Well, Holly Hunt is actually one of my design heroes, so I share that with you. You mentioned mentoring, which is an issue that comes up a lot these days, and I wonder, is that a cornerstone of what the ASID tries to engage in or help make happen?
Absolutely. It's something we actively participate in. We have several programs. During the pandemic, one of them that came up was suddenly we couldn't have internships. So ASID immediately started doing virtual internships across the country. And it's something we're going to continue to do even when we all go back to work. And here's the reason. What we learned is a student in San Diego can take an internship with Roz Kama, one of the top interior designers in the healthcare industry in the world, not just America, but in the world, and take an internship with her. If I had that when I was a student, I would have jumped over the moon. And it leads to jobs. So that's one of them. Another a wonderful program that we started 4 or 5 years ago is called Ones to Watch. And it's part of our diversity and inclusion programs, but it really is about hitting the glass ceiling no matter where you are in the interior design profession. So people of color, both Black and Hispanic and Asian, but also women, say, in large architectural firms and engineering firms that can't move up.
I want to get back to the equity issue, and I want to get back to the diversity issue, but we were talking a little bit about sort of returning to work earlier, and I want to give some people some context around your own career a little bit, because you thought you were sort of wrapping up your own work, and suddenly you've been sort of pulled back in to the role you're in now. So for the benefit of listeners fully understanding, you were in the process of thinking about retiring from your career, right?
I had. In fact, I posted it on Facebook that I was retired. and that was last May.
That was last May. So you said, I'm retired. Good news. I'm wrapping things up. And then what happened for you?
And then 2 weeks later, I received a phone call from Jennifer Kallstad, the head of design at Ford Motor Company, one of my heroes, talking about heroes. She said, Gary, I have a request. And I said, yeah, anything for you. And she said, I'd like you to become temporary CEO of ASID. And it's nothing that had ever even crossed my mind in my entire career. I mean, why would an organization ask me to do something like that? And she explained that they wanted someone to come in. Randy Fizer was leaving. He took a wonderful new position, and he's one of my mentors. But she said, we want someone to come in and help us rebuild community. The world has changed. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute when we talk about chapters and membership. But she said, we want somebody to help us rebuild community, and we feel you are the one because that's what you do. You build partnerships and teaming. So I said, okay. She said, how long? 3 to 6 months. Okay. So 3 months later, I'm now the permanent CEO for at least another 2 years. I was thinking year and a half, 2 years. Get us through all of this. I do want to slow down. That is my goal. I'm working longer hours than I've ever worked, but it's also very, very rewarding and satisfying.
And what did you imagine you would be able to do? What did you imagine was the impact that you would be able to make at sort of this fascinating time in history?
Well, interestingly enough, I was told, it won't be much. You know, you're going to be the public voice, and we can't travel or go to conferences anymore or anything. So it's not going to be all that much work. So again, as usual, they lied to you. But
you were tricked.
I was tricked. But I thought, I had been thinking for a while, and the pandemic brought this to a head. The interior design profession is at a crossroads. We've had this infighting between residential and contract forever, and we got to get over it. I'm sick of it. We're done. But so that was one of the reasons I thought, well, maybe I can do something about that to help it. But really what the pandemic has done for me, it's kind of, we're in a tornado. First we had the Me Too issue. Then we had Black Lives Matter, which has now come back this week in Minneapolis. And then we had the pandemic. Now, normally each of these would last 3 months and we'd move on to the next issue. But they all three happened right one after the other after the other. And it's kind of blown our world apart as a nation and as a globe, because they've all three gone everywhere. So to me, it's like not only has the door been opened, but it's been blown off its hinges. Interior designers deal with the individual, with the human, with their mental health, their wellness, their happiness, their inclusion. We make spaces where people want to be and feel safe and comfortable. This is our opportunity. And if our profession doesn't leap through this opening and lead coming out of the pandemic, shame on us. So the reason I took on the permanent position was when I saw this opportunity to move the profession forward. Working together, all of the organizations that deal with the design industry and profession, moving us forward to making things better for the living condition. This is so important.
Known for their unique coastal-inspired mix, Serena and Lily makes good design their business, working with trade professionals like you to transform interiors. Join their trade program to enjoy trade-only events and discounts, COM and complimentary swatches, and services tailored to your specific needs, like extra customization options and extended returns. You can even use their design shops as an extension of your workspace. Become a trade member at serenaandlily.com/trade. And now, back to the show. You touched on something earlier that I know has been a thread of a challenge for a long time. You mentioned this sort of this infighting between commercial and residential, and that you wanted to put an end to that. Tell me what that infighting is all about. What's at play there?
You know, I think it goes back to, you know, a lot of years and decorating. You know, being called pillow fluffers, decorators, the architects on legislative issues use that term all the time, by the way, still to this day. We just had that used against us in Nebraska.
Pillow fluffers? They call, really?
Yes. So this isn't old news. This is current news. And so IIDA and ASID came together and said, stop it. You know, that's not who we are. We have an exam. We cover codes. We know what we're talking about. But the real issue has gone on, not only was it outside of our profession by others, but also internally, because when we tried to elevate the profession and make it a profession, started about 50 years ago, seriously, and we put in the NCIDQ exam and other things. It began and changed our schools and had certification for the universities and everything. It began to raise the bar. Now, part of that is you become exclusive by doing that. You have to take this exam in order to be participant. That's a good thing because it did elevate the profession. However, it also then began drawing lines of, you're not as good as me. I'm better than you. And there are many very good designers, interior designers and interior architects that don't necessarily have the same degree that I have. That's part of the world. We're becoming more inclusive now than we used to be. But this fighting between corporate and residential really needs to go because most of us now, it's really interesting dealing with firms because I'm talking a lot to mid and small size firms. By the way, 80% of the membership of AIA, ASID, and IIDA come from small firms, under 200 people, and most 20 or fewer. Therefore, they need to stay in business. Many of them are doing very well right now because those that were practicing only corporate are now doing residential. They've learned that there's a lot to come from the residential market, and it used to be lessons learned going from corporate over to the residential side. Now, thankfully, what's going on right now is what we know about residential and how people live and how they've needed to adapt and become flexible in their living conditions, that is going to come into the corporate world. Lessons learned from the pandemic are going to go the other way.
A couple of things there. One, we talked about the NCIDQ, and we should just explain for listeners what that organization is and what that the issue of the exam and everything around that. And if you can just
sure.
a quick explainer on
NCIDQ
that.
NCIDQ was, its initials don't mean much anymore, but it is, it's a freestanding, independent organization. CIDQ is the organization that runs it, but it is all about making sure that there is an exam that tests minimum requirements for the practice of interior design. Much like NCARB, the National Architectural Exam, tests minimum requirements for an architect. Not advanced, minimal. And that's what NCIDQ is. It's an exam for the interior designer. It's required in all the states, the 23 or 4 states that have some form of licensure. That is the measurement, is this exam. And that is what we use in schools for teaching. Mm-hmm. What it takes to pass that exam is built into most curricula.
Is that exam or is the lack of not having taken this exam part of why the residential interior designers often are looked down upon by these other industry professionals?
Yes, absolutely. And it's primarily because most residential designers do not need it to practice because you're not dealing directly with codes and occupancy on a day-to-day basis like you are in the corporate world where you're dealing with, you know, getting people out safely and distances from exits and all of those issues, mechanical, electrical. Where in residential, typically, you aren't dealing with that, and therefore, most states don't require residential designers to have the exam. Now, many of them, a lot of my friends have taken the exam because they want it, but it's not required by law. And so it is used, we use it against each other, which it should not be.
Well, so tell me what that means and how does that play out when you use it against each other?
Well, that's that pointing the fingers thing. I have it, you don't. I'm better than you because I've taken this exam. Well, I am maybe on one side because I have minimum qualifications, but you probably know things I have no idea about. And that's what I want to open up the profession, is accepting that others have knowledge that we all need, and it's not just because I took an exam.
Back when I could go to people's offices, if we can cast our mind back that far, I was in the office of a highly noted interior designer, and she held up a blueprint and she said to me, "Dennis, where does this architect think I'm putting a bed in this space? What room has this architect left me to actually make this room livable?" Is that part of what is at the heart of this sort of ever thus conflict in the industry?
Absolutely. And that's a very good point. One deals primarily with volume, external facades and volumes. The other deals with the individual and how they're going to use that volume. That's why we're both so important. The best projects I've ever worked on is when we were at the table day one together. Because I can't tell you how many times I've held up a blueprint and said, you want me to put 250 people in here? It won't hold 100. And it's the same with a bed. A bed is just, you know, like a desk. They're all about space planning, and it's all about understanding relationships within space. And the bedroom doesn't go next to the kitchen. Those two things don't, you know, but yep, that I can't tell you how many floor plans I've seen where I've said, no. And by the way, the engineer should be at the table day one too. So the people doing the mechanical and electrical systems, you know, we whine all the time because we walk in and the thermostat in the middle of the dining room wall, right where a major painting should go or a piece of art. Well, that's because they weren't invited to the table. That's our fault. So I always have the engineers, the architects, and the interior designers day one. And that's what happens when you finally get to lead a program instead of follow. And too often, interior designers are on the second tier on projects. They're brought in after, as opposed to at the same time, and sometimes before. If you become the trusted advisor to your clients, if you stick through with them through this pandemic and are there for them to help them modify, they will come to you forever and they will pick you first and talk to you first, and you will tell the architect where the bed is going to go.
Well, so one of the things that you've told me the ASID is focused on is advocacy. And one of the things that you shared with me when we last spoke was that one of the myriad of challenges that you face is this issue of the right to practice and not be taxed as a luxury. So you said that every state is trying to tax interior designers, not architects, as a luxury. So correct. So help me understand what's going on there.
And that's, you know, every state needs money. And there's a big movement to deregulate everything. So half the country is trying to deregulate. When they deregulate, they want a tax. So it's really strange because in many states where they're trying to deregulate interior design, they're regulating people that give manicures and braid hair and things like that, as if that has a health safety issue, whereas we actually do, because we put materials in homes that can catch fire and give off bad gases and all this kind of thing. So we are a profession that should be regulated to meet minimum requirements, no matter where you practice. That's one. But that taxation issue, we are looked at in many states as a luxury. And that's because they don't understand what we do. And so our advocacy program is to educate legislatures and have them understand what it is interior designers do and their impact on the built environment. But more and more, we're all going to see interior design services trying to be taxed as a luxury. And we have to stay on the forefront to stop that. And ASID is really there. We monitor every state constantly.
Well, so how do states frame that issue when you say interior design taxed as a luxury? What are they taxing exactly?
Anything you do. So your services, what you charge your fees, and the products you sell to your clients. If you're in residential and you buy and sell product on behalf of your clients, they're going to tax that. Not just sales tax, luxury tax. And the fees that you charge, they're going to tax that. So it's a big deal, especially for our residential clients.
So what are some of the states that are presenting this as an issue and where you're really having a challenge?
Primarily throughout the South. Anywhere there is and it's not always, but generally a Republican government that's trying to deregulate will then take the stand of taxation. And you can understand the taxation issue because everybody needs money, especially now. But ASID says interior designers are not a luxury. We're a mandatory necessity. All of us need support and good design. And good design doesn't have to cost a lot of money. Some of my best projects had horrible budgets. One of them, just as an example, in my early days, Apple Computer, when they were in deep trouble and everyone thought they were going to go under, I was doing offices for them and opening them regionally. And then after I got them open, they came back and said, now you got to close them. because Steve Jobs had left and things were going downhill. But during that process, the thing that came up to me was, Gary, you can do anything you want as long as you use sheetrock and paint. That was the truth. That was so. In other words, zero budget.
Exactly. No money.
No money. But yeah, we'll give you some paint, a bucket of paint, and some sheetrock, and you can design around it. Some of the best projects I ever did because you learned about solving the problem and making it interesting for the users. So I think that is what this is about. Whether you know you're Kia Weatherspoon doing this wonderful work in high rises in New York and stuff for people that need subsidized housing, or you're doing fancy hotels, it doesn't make any difference. Design is design, and all of us need it. It impacts everyone.
Well, and you've mentioned that you've been successful thus far in battling this taxation issue. Is the risk in losing in some of these states that designers would end up owing more money in their taxes or the price of goods would go up?
Their firms would be taxed, and therefore they would have to up their billings to their clients or eat it. But yes, so far we have never lost, you know, knock on wood.
Right.
You don't want to say that. So far we've been successful in keeping that away. And that's why it's so important that ASID and IIDA work together on this, because it affects the whole profession, not just one side of the table.
We touched on the exam issue earlier. What is the perception right now? Are you advocating for more interior designers to just step up and take this exam and let's get on our way to people taking us more seriously? Or what's the position that you're taking?
Yes. Yes, and.
Okay.
I'm still a huge advocate for the exam. And the reason is that for yourself, by the way, the clients don't rarely, except the federal government, ask if you're NCIDQ qualified. By the way, the federal government requires that you be an NCIDQ qualified interior designer to work on their work for the Department of Defense and State Department and things like that.
Okay, so for government contracts, it's absolutely required.
That's absolutely
that you
required.
Have passed the NCIDQ exam.
So, but for our profession, it's not. And most interior designers and most young architects that work in large firms, the Genslers of the world, don't need to take it because somebody else is signing the drawings and they really don't need to worry about it. But I always advocate that you should take it for yourself. It's for you. Whether you do residential or contract makes no difference. Take the exam because it then says to you, you know what you're talking about. It makes you more powerful and it makes you stronger when you say something to a client or to another professional. So when you're talking to an architect across the table, you know what you're saying and you have the background and the qualifications to say it. So from that standpoint, I'm a huge advocate for the exam. The other side of it is I'm also an advocate for everyone who is interested in the interior design or design professions to be invited to the table. Diversity of voice and knowledge and background is imperative. And I don't find that here in the United States, that we have diverse voices at the design table.
Okay. So I want to, so let's get into that. You and I were talking the other day. You were in London, you sit down in a meeting, and there's people of so many different races and religions, and you just feel like you're in a global city. And often you don't experience that in the United States in the same way. So tell me about that.
I think that was my biggest eye-opener coming back to the U.S. I spent 12 years in London working and got so used to it, it didn't even cross my mind. But I had my own company there for 8 of those 12 years. I had only 4 employees that were British. Everybody else was from Eastern Europe, Africa, Australia, from all over. We're all sitting at the table with different ideas and experiences and different views through our eyes. So no matter what project you were working on, you know, one of you is still responsible to the client and has to make the final decisions. But when we would do design charrettes, we would have such diverse voices And so if we're doing a project in the Middle East, we had several Muslims on our staff. So they would say, no, you can't do that. Well, why? It's beautiful. That doesn't fit the culture. And it's because in America, I find that we think we're monolithic culturally. And we're really not, as we're seeing, really seeing right now through all the problems that we're having, is that for too long, we thought we were pretty much on the same plane. And we're not. And that's good. We shouldn't be. We should have diversity. We should celebrate that diversity and take advantage of it. The design professions are abysmal, all of us, with our diversity, less than 3%. And that has not improved in 25 years, maybe a little bit, maybe a half a percentage point. We must be much more active. And that means getting into schools at junior high and high school and explaining what a profession is dealing with design. Because most kids all over don't have a clue what an interior designer is, except maybe they've seen something bad on TV. And we need to get into our schools and talk to kids long before they go to university.
Well, it's an enormous challenge for the industry, and as you say, our industry is woefully. It's the percentages are just embarrassing, and it's wonderful that it has become an issue that so many important people are talking about. But the needle needs to move more in the direction, as you were saying earlier, around equity versus the whole equality issue. That's nice, but it's not just inviting them to the events, as you were saying, but really getting them a seat at the table and getting them licensing deals and all the same levels of participation that have been available to so many others in the industry. I would imagine that's probably one of the biggest issues that you're probably working on trying to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And it is about that. All of us coming together and not doing what we did in the past, which as ticking boxes. We can't do that anymore. We must move the compass. We've got to move forward. Now is our opportunity. The door's open. We got to do it.
Artistic Tile offers a meticulously curated selection of natural stone slabs, sourced from quarries around the world. Its 20,000 square foot state-of-the-art slab gallery is fully stocked with unique specimens, and just minutes from Midtown Manhattan. Find a standout statement piece or that elusive, perfect neutral, either virtually or in person. Make your appointment at artistictile.com/BOH. And now, back to the show.
You touched on chapters earlier, and I know that that's often a challenge in a big national organization. I'm a New Yorker, and the New York chapter of the ASID hasn't historically, for me, to our earlier conversation about design heroes or people that we would recognize as leaders in the industry, it hasn't seemed to have been well represented in the New York chapter, just for example. What do you do about that kind of a challenge? What's
New York is, I think, the third largest chapter we have. And to me, New York is the center of the interior design universe globally, not just for America, but globally. I've always wondered why it has been. It goes up and down. All chapters, by the way, go up and down. But it has, from time to time, been the flag bearer, and other times it's been the follower. A lot of that has to do with secession and people moving up. But when it becomes cliquish and you only bring in your friends, it becomes a sorority or a fraternity. Mm. And the larger chapters have a problem with doing that. So it's not just New York. But larger chapters, quite often, they'll get a group of 12 to 15 to 20 that rotate through the system. They forget that they need to mentor and bring in new people. It's the same thing you do if you work for a larger company. The very first thing I always did, who's going to take my place? Because I can't grow, I can't move up until I find my replacement. We need to do that in the chapters too. And we need to take away things like governance, that filing tax reports, which they all have to do. And it's a pain because you're not trained to do that as an interior designer for for an association, you know. And so we need to help, and we're going to, we already are, our chapters get relief in that area so they can become compliant, relieving them of that so they can concentrate on programs and services to their members. And so having great speakers and interactions, not just cocktail parties. Yes, we need a cocktail party, but we need knowledge and experience and expertise shared with the members to elevate them and expose them to new ideas and thinking and research.
It seems as if it would be so much more meaningful if so many of the leaders, so many of the most highly recognized interior designers in the industry were more a part of ASID. And maybe they are in certain chapters. I don't see that representation in New York, and I'm not overly familiar with sort of seeing sort of household name designers saying that they're proud members of the ASID and that they want to be engaged in mentoring and helping the careers of the next generation. Is that a challenge for the organization? Is that
well, that's interesting that you would say that, because we do have a lot of big name designers as part of the association. You know, I haven't been to a New York meeting since I got
there. And I don't mean to keep picking on New York.
No. It's where you're from, so therefore I understand why you would ask that question. You know, I think of other cities like Chicago with John Celloni, who is a global residential interior designer. Everyone knows him. Or Carrie Kelly in California. So I know big name designers that are really, really active participants. I don't know the New York chapter as I used to, because the 12 years in London divorced me from that. So right. I need to get back in and do that. So maybe one of the things, when we open up, I'll come out and you and I'll go check things out together and see why that isn't there, or if it is, why we don't know about it.
Well, I would love that, and sign me up for that. I think you and I are already scheduled to go and visit Jim Druckmann at the New York Design Center.
Yes.
And follow up on some of his comments in a recent interview that we did with him, where part of what he talked about, and I wonder if you how you think about this. Part of what he talked about is just wanting to educate people about the value of interior design. He felt as though the ASID had the opportunity to be this marketing arm, in a way, for the interior design industry and help so many of these newly affluent people in the world today better understand the value of investing in working with an interior designer.
And I think that's where the complication comes in. We're a member organization, not a social organization. So our job is not to market on behalf of our members. Our job is, though, to elevate the profession in the public's mind. And that's where our research is being used, and we're putting it out there. We do a year report, which was just released a couple weeks ago, that gets quoted in the New York Times and Forbes and Wall Street Journal, where your clients, our clients, go for information. One of my big pushes at ASID is, let's quit talking only to the design press. Let's talk to the business press, the press that our clients read, no matter what area they practice in. So what is it that the clients read? You know, I've been watching when I sit in the lounge at the Delta Business Lounge. What magazines do they pick up off the free rack and look through? Which ones do they take with them? Which ones do they leave behind? It kind of tells you what the potential client's interests are. So we need to do more research on that, and the profession needs to do this together. How do we get a better voice to the public and not just HGTV? 60-minute makeover is not what interior design is about. What it's about is solving problems, and of course it's going to be beautiful. That's the outcome. The real issue is helping your clients solve problems. And that's where I think the disconnect comes in. You know, 200 Lex has been where I went my whole career, you know, and I know it well. And so I think it's sad that we feel that there's this disconnect because it didn't used to be there. And again, like I said, I've been out of the country a while. I need to re-understand what the disconnect is. So that's why I'm looking forward to our call. What is it, in 2 weeks, I think it is, and after I'm back in the U.S. But I think that it's really interesting that the whole New York market has gone through this kind of dramatic change from leading to following, and I think it's being set up for leading again. I think there's some really good things happening there, and we have to help them, and they've asked for our help. There was a time, it's kind of like DIFA. You know, it's shrunk, it's gotten larger, it's shrunk, it's gotten larger. Right now, it's on a really great course. They're really doing good things, and they're bringing in all the chapters to the table again, which is very important. So ASID is having to do the same. We were looking at the bigger picture for a long time. Randy Fizer, the former CEO, led a great advocacy and research arm, thank goodness, because it changed who we are. But part of that was we didn't pay as much attention to the chapters. Now we need to do both. Research and advocacy is moving forward beautifully. I'm going to get us back in tune with the chapters and knowledge communities. So that's one of our new initiatives, is creating knowledge communities, whether it's dealing with practice areas like residential or contract, but also with needs like business needs. What do small firms need? What do you know about insurance? What do you know about filing your taxes? Do you have consultants that you work with? Finding courses and providing knowledge for the members to be better at what they do.
Well, and this is part of what I'm trying to sort of wrap my arms around. If I'm an interior designer and I am listening to this discussion, what is going to compel me to write a check for, how much am I writing a check for to the ASID? How
As
much
a professional member, it's about $500.
Okay, so I'm going to write a check for $500 because joining the ASID is going to educate me, is going to better prepare me, is going to create a community for me. I mean, is that essentially what you think are sort of the most important elements as people are considering?
Certainly part of that, half of it is the training and it's free. You know, like our virtual conference, which will be in July, as an ASID member, all of the CEU programs are free. And so you take them and you get your credits and you can learn whatever you want to learn about. The other part of it is, and by the way, we're doing that. We're going to open it up to the broader design profession like we did last year. Anyone who signs up for conference can take the CEUs for free. That's one. Education, knowledge, sharing, community. Community is a big part of this. I think the other part is, if you just looked at the CEU programs and Dr. Chung's report, as I mentioned earlier, on the state of the profession, those two things are, well, about $1,000 value. So already as a professional member, if you take advantage of those two things, you've more than paid for your dues right there, plus everything else that you have opportunity to have. Access to the research, access to the network, access to the partners we have with business, our industry partners, which are huge, people like Benjamin Moore and Cosentino, who really, and Sherwin-Williams, on and on, Herman Miller, Hayworth, who really support us and the interior design profession moving forward, who come to us for our research and knowledge so that they can do better at what they do. And I think that's where we come in.
Well, and tell me a little bit about that research. What is it showing? What is it telling you?
Well, it's saying that the residential is going to be strong for the next 2 years, which is great. Corporate work, if you're doing global accounts, going to be poor. So the big guys are going to hurt, sorry to say. But if you're the trusted advisor to a client, you're going to continue.
But residential... This is their moment to shine.
To shine. And what I think we've learned, you know, we all went to open planning at home, you know, the kitchen, living room, dining room all together. Well, now it's an office for two people and a school room and a playroom and the dogs and the cats. And I have to cook and you have to have a conference call with your boss. This is teaching us that our residences have to be flexible They are, but adaptable. And they weren't designed to be adaptable right now. Open plan is wonderful for family, bad for work. And if you're going to continue to work at home at least 2 days a week, we have to solve this problem. So residential is really our research. We have a task force of 40 working on residential issues. And they're looking at everything. So that's one of them, is how are we going to make residential adaptive and flexible? Two, how are you going to do it for multi-generational? All the kids have moved home, can't afford to keep an apartment in downtown New York and not go into the office. But I've learned that I can live in New Jersey with mom and dad for a while and still do my job. And by the way, grandma and grandpa moved home. So we're going to have this multi-generational, I think, much more like Europe has had historically, I think we're going to start having more in America. I think that's part of what's coming out of this. And the corporate design side is going to need what the residential designers have learned to bring back into corporate world. How do we make people feel comfortable? How do we make them feel safe? How do we give them a desk and a place to have what you and I are doing right now, a conference? Because this isn't going to go away just because we go back to the office. It's going to be more of it. And there's new systems that we're all going to be three-dimensional and feel like we can be in the same room together, and I can touch you, and I can do a post-it note, and you can read it as I do it live. That's going to be here very shortly. I had a demonstration this week. So
really? So tell me about that.
You're going to put on your 3D headset. You and I are both going to have it. We're going to be in the same room. I'm going to see you. You're going to see me. We're going to be able to walk around. I can write on a flip chart or on a post-it note and put it up on the wall and you can read it. We can have a conversation where we don't interrupt each other when we try to talk, where the mic takes over, a real conversation. So we're going to have the ability to feel that we're almost together three-dimensionally. Now, the problem is when you put that headset on, you're going to walk into the wall. So we have to design the rooms for this.
Figure out some of that.
And we're working on that. So that's where the interior designer comes in, is that we're going to be designing these rooms so you and I can have a safe and productive conversation live. And there can be 20 of us or there can be two of us. And so I'm looking forward to that. I think that will make this kind of communication much more real and much more exciting going forward.
I had been dismissive of this conversation going on recently about people who have been investing in virtual real estate, but maybe this is an opportunity that I need to take more seriously based on what you're telling me.
Yes, I think it is. I would do a little investigation.
Interesting. Okay. Well, this is a whole other conversation, Gary. So I can't wait for you
That's
to get back to the
hour,
States.
So we're yes. here, stop now.
Yes. We will delve into that another time. But we've covered so much here, and I really appreciate you making the time to get into all of this, because I it's been a great conversation, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. No, this is a great opportunity, and I think you all are doing a great job. I just finished reading the current issue.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I'd show it to you, but no one can see it. And I think it's really important that we keep pushing quality and diversity and professionalism on all levels, from low to high to medium. Everyone should have an interior designer's point of view to help them. And I think that's where Business of Home really is important, because you're getting to the communities that we need to impress, not impress as in, you know, expensive interiors, but impress with, we can help you do better. We can help you live better and feel better and feel safe.
Well, and that's always been my position, and that interior designers should always be at the table and have a voice, and they can contribute in so many ways. So I completely agree, and I appreciate you making that point. And I look forward to your trip to New York soon. We sounds like we have a lot of work to do. So
it does, and I'm looking forward to it. Great to finally get to meet you and talk to you, and this has been fun. Thank you.
Thank you. A pleasure. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job postings, or join our BOH Insider membership community for access to exclusive online educational workshops, a free print subscription, a private Facebook group, and more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. This show was produced by Fred Nikolaus and edited by Albert Burge for Podfly. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you next week.